Well, welcome to Vox on this third Sunday of Easter. And so this is the season where historically the church has set aside. And just to be reminded of resurrection walking with and among us, and to consider that day to day, what does that look like here and now? And so I thought on this third Sunday of Easter, we could talk about fermentation. Cool? So why don't we do this? Turn to someone next to you and share a food item that involves fermentation. Many of them are very delicious that you enjoy. So I've got a list up there in case you need some help. On this list, many of you may not have tasted the thousand-year-old egg, but it is excellent. Go ahead. I'll give you some time. What are your favorite fermented foods? So anyone have any fermented food items that are not on the list?
Beer.
It's on there, isn't it? Didn't I not put beer in there? Oh, I'm sorry. Anybody else? It's pretty important, huh? Anything else? Stinky tofu. Has anyone had stinky tofu? So picture like a deep fried wok and dirty socks, and then we eat it, and it's awesome. All right. Anybody else? Okay. How do you say that?
Cortito.
Cortito. Yeah. Very nice. Anybody else? So I was thinking through fermented foods and deliciousness and cheese. And has anyone seen Michael Pollan's latest documentary series called Cooked? And in the last episode, he talks about the earth and microorganisms and bacteria that bring forth decay, out of decay, tastiness. And so he spends some time with a nun, a very cute nun, on a Benedictine monastery. And she has her PhD in microbiology. And they talk about cheese. So check it out.
Cheesemaker cultivates the microbes that create the flavors of a mature cheese.
And what you do with that fresh cheese can lead to this huge diversity in flavor and texture, in aroma, in appearance that you have in the wide world of cheese.
So one thing you can do is you can heavily inoculate that cheese, add a lot of mold to that cheese, and that becomes a Blumirind cheese. And that would be a Camembert or Brie are two really great examples of Blumirind cheeses. Another thing you can do is you can wash the surface of the cheese. As the cheese is aging, it's washed repeatedly over and over again with a salt solution, usually about 2 times a week, depending on the cheese. And it creates this very disturbed, sort of constantly mixed system that encourages the growth of these particular microbes. And examples of washed rind cheeses would be Limburger and Taleggio, these sort of stinky, often orange or sometimes pink cheeses. The final thing you can do is not a whole lot. You sort of just let the cheese set on a shelf, and you flip the cheese occasionally to make sure it has proper drainage, but you don't really do anything dramatic to the outside of the cheese.
People used caves because it could get a cheese close to the earth. And the microorganisms were in the earth, then they grew on the cheese. This is alive. So it's hard to control, and it's going to be the environment that controls it. So you have to spend a lot of time observing, smelling, and I smell, by the way. You just have to smell everything.
Which is true. You do have to smell everything. This is what Michael Pollan says. I soon came to see that for Mother Noella, the miracles of Christ were many and could be witnessed in the unlikeliest of places, including a barrel of milk or under a microscope. Several of Christ's miracles rather famously involve fermentation, as she pointed out to me with a twinkle, like bread and wine. Cheese is the transformation of ordinary matter into something extraordinary, a process suggestive of transcendence. And so a few weeks before Easter, we talked about dying well, and this is what we said. We read this quote, and this quote said, "There is such a thing as a good death. We are responsible for the way we die. We have to choose between clinging to life in such a way that death becomes nothing but a failure, or letting go of life in freedom so that we can be given to others as a source of hope." And then Jesus said it like this, "Very truly, I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and it dies, it just remains a single grain. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. And the question we asked then before Easter was, how do we continue to die well in order to live fully? And we talked about this idea of composting. You help things, you foster its death to bring forth life. And then after that sermon, Amy emailed me. He's like, Michael Pollan talks about cheese and decay and fermentation, and you have to watch it. And so I think oftentimes we talk about death, we talk about dying, and then we jump to resurrection. And the question I want to ask this morning is, how about the in-between stage, when things are fermenting, when life is about to begin? What does that feel like? What does that taste like? What words would we use to describe it? And so the question this morning as we go into John chapter 21 is this. What words might we use to describe the taste and smell of fermentation, of life about to birth in our lives? Or another way to ask it could be like this. How might we describe spiritual fermentation in our lives today, here and now? So we're going to be in the last chapter of John. Go ahead and read verses 1 through 8 on the screen, and then we'll walk through it. All right, go. All right, so this morning, you know, what can we learn about this pattern of decay to life, of death to life? And then in the in-between, what are some things in our lives that maybe we can pay attention to or notice and say, hey, maybe some fermentation, maybe some new life is being birthed here. So let's pick this up in verse 1. It says, after these things, Jesus showed himself again, so this wasn't the first time, to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. And then he showed himself in this way. Gathered there together were Simon Peter, Thomas called the Twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples. And then Simon goes, hey, I'm going fishing. And then they go, all right, we'll come too. And then they went out and got into the boat. And then they're fishing all night, and they don't catch anything. And so the writer of John, it's supposed to bring us back to something. It's deja vu. This happened before. Then in the morning, Jesus stood on the beach, and so he just appears, but the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So this story starts, and resurrection is right in front of them. They've seen it before already, but they still don't expect it, so they don't recognize it. And I wonder if we have things in our lives where expectations aren't met or they're surprising, and maybe we don't recognize that maybe resurrection is happening in front of us. So you think back, this is supposed to beckon us back to the first time Jesus invites them on the beach where they don't catch anything. He sends them back into the water and the nets are full of fish. And they're probably thinking to that first time, they're probably thinking, all right, this is an interesting rabbi. I'll follow him. Those were their expectations. And then he turns out maybe that this is the Christ, the Messiah. And you think back to the days leading up to this, how many surprises, how many expectations were blown out of the water. So they think they're just having supper, ends up being the Last Supper. Surprise. They think this is a movement that's going to change the world. But in order to change the world, it comes through betrayal. Surprise. It turns out to be an inside job. Surprise. They go to the garden and they're praying in their most sacred and vulnerable space, and then they're betrayed. Surprise. Peter defends himself. He defends the movement. And Jesus goes, no, 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 we're not defending this. Surprise. Then he's on trial. And they're thinking, surely he's going to say something, do something, perform something. And he does nothing, says nothing. Surprise. Then on the cross, he actually dies. Surprise. And every step of the way, what they thought would happen didn't happen. And when resurrection is standing in front of them, they don't recognize it. Oswald Chambers says it like this. He says, certainty is the mark of the common sense life. Gracious uncertainty is the mark of the spiritual life. To be certain of God means that we are uncertain in all our ways, not knowing what tomorrow may bring. This generally is expressed with a sigh of sadness. So he's saying, when something's unexpected, our young palate, we don't like it. We're sad about it. But it should be an expression of breathless expectation. So maybe we should tune and mature our palate when something's unexpected or surprise, to see it with expectation. But we are uncertain of the next step, but we are certain of God. As soon as we abandon ourselves to God and do the task he has placed closest to us, he begins to fill our life with surprises. And for us, maybe just to consider, maybe in this coming week, you know, what are some expectations that we had that we think of now that are just not what we expected? Maybe our marriage, maybe our relationships, maybe relationships that are ending, maybe our spiritual life. When you were beckoned into following Christ, what did you expect would happen in 5 years, 10 years? And what if we expect time and again to be surprised? I was listening to this story on Radiolab called Gray, I think it's called Gray's Donation. Did anyone listen to this? And it tells a story of these two young parents who find out they're expecting twins. And then along the way, they find out that one of the twins probably isn't going to make it, and the other one's going to. And so they say the whole birthing process and the 9 months leading up to it, it's this huge roller coaster, because they said they were both planning like a birth. They're buying like a car seat and a crib, having baby showers while planning a funeral for the other baby. And so the day of the birth comes, and the one that's supposed to be, he has some skull deformation from a disease he has. They're expecting him to be a stillborn, and he makes it. And then the other one who's supposed to be healthy kind of struggles for a few days. And then the one with the disease ends up making it for 6 days, and then they have a funeral, and then they grieve his death for the rest of the year. And they said it was kind of a surreal experience. After the funeral, they had donated his body to science, so this vehicle came and picked up the body. And then for the rest of the year, they just got these thank you letters from all these different labs around the country thanking them for the generous donation. Then a year passes, and then the mom really wanted to mark this moment and to grieve it well so that they could begin talking about Gray in the past, because it had been a year. And so she went around and started calling all the different labs that got different parts of her son, trying to find out if he was useful and valuable, whether it was helping research. And that first year, every call she made kind of led to a dead end, doors were closed, and then she kind of left it and walked away. Then another year passes. Then on the second year of the anniversary of Gray's death, she was doing a lecture in Boston at a conference center. And then from across the street, she recognized the name of the lab, which was the lab that they had sent the eyes of her son to. So during the lunch hour, she walks across the street and just knocks on the door, and then finally starts talking to people and just, hey, I just wanted to find out what happened to my son's eyes. She asks and asks and finally meets the researcher who's a professor at Harvard. And he sits her down and he says, I can't tell you how valuable your son's eyes are. Most donations come later in life, but when we have the eyes of a newborn, they continue to regenerate themselves. And 2 years later, your son's eyes are invaluable. And so it meant so much to her that, you know, this donation was such a valuable thing. So she started chasing down all the different labs. And then she ends up at Duke in Durham, and she's talking to a researcher who had gotten the blood samples from the spine of both the twins. And they said to have the blood of the spine of identical twins, where one got the disease and one didn't, they said it was a breakthrough in researching the disease that this twin got. And then the mom asked the researcher this question. And then she said, well, were you surprised when you got the blood samples? And what the researcher said was this, and when he said it, it kind of struck me. He said, you know what? It was better than a surprise. He said, to be surprised means I had some sort of expectation. He says, I didn't even know what to expect. And I wonder for us, in our life with God, in our life with each other, in our careers, in our marriages, just to name those expectations. And when those expectations aren't met or we're surprised, to notice, hey, maybe there's new life forming. Maybe there's the possibility of fermentation. Ronald Rollheiser says it like this. The resurrection tells us it's never too late. Every so often, we will be surprised. We must believe that the stone will be rolled back, and we must be ready to poke out our timid heads, to take off the linen bindings of death and walk free for a time, breathing resurrection air. And so in verse 4, Jesus stood on the beach and the disciples did not know it was Jesus. I don't know if this happened. I kind of picture Jesus going, they don't recognize me. This is going to be an awesome surprise, right? I just picture him doing that in his head. So what happens is the exact same thing that happens in his first invitation. So they go, hey, did you catch anything? They're like, no, we didn't catch anything. They're like, well, why don't you put the net on the right side of the boat? And they put it in, and then they pull, it's full of fish. And then there's 153 fish, which means something, but no one knows what. Okay? So it's full of fish. And then John goes, it's Jesus! And then Peter is like, I'm naked, puts on some clothes, jumps in the water. And then they're coming back on shore, and then Jesus has a fire started already, and he's like, hey, come on. Verse 12, it says, come have breakfast. Now, none of them disciples dared ask him, who are you? Because they totally knew it was the Lord, all of them. They totally knew it. And Jesus came, took bread, gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third day. When new things happen, when Jesus appeared to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. So in this story, you have to imagine the disciples think that this movement is over. It's ended. These last 3 years of walking with him, the most spectacular, unexpected, full of surprises, it's done. I don't know. I'm going back. I guess I'm fishing. I had a good run. This is ending. And what commentators say is this is an ending, but it repeats the beginning. And as something is ending, it's also signifying that something is about to begin. T.S. Eliot says like this, what we call the beginning is often the end. And to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. And I think sometimes we're so consumed by mourning the end of something, we forget to notice, oh, maybe something else is about to begin. You know, a lot of times we celebrated the baptism last year. And so historically, a lot of the times the church taught it as a finish line. And in the last few years, we've talked about, no, that's not a finish line, it's a beginning line. But I think more important than that, when someone is baptized, when we're baptized, it's supposed to remind us this is the pattern of life. Things end and then it begins. Things die and then they birth. You know, if you think about relationships, this is how relationships work. So Karen and I, we've been married 18 years now, which is a really long time. And I've just been thinking through how many things in our relationship, this is how healthy relationships form. Things end, seasons end, and then new seasons begin. So we met, it was a blistery cold winter in Chicago in the winter, December of 1993. And in my mind, I don't know if this actually happened, this is what I pictured. This door opens and a blizzard comes blowing through, and then a light comes from behind her and the Hallelujah chorus just starts singing. And then in walks this girl with a beanie and a scarf with a blue backpack on and then this plaid jacket, and I just was like, hello, who is that? Then I managed to talk to her very awkwardly, and we exchanged phone numbers, and she asked for my email. I didn't know what an email was, and I researched an email, got an email, and started talking. And then later that summer, a few months later, her family had moved to Atlanta, and I remember this different evening, and instead of it being blistery cold, it was kind of like this hot, muggy Georgian summer. And we went for a walk, and I held her hand for the first time. We sat on these swings, and I remember there were cicadas in the back singing for us, just cheering for us. Do it! You're falling in love, right? We had our first kiss. So I remember that first season I would describe as the season of kind of like our first date. Like I was putting forth the best version of myself. I can fake it for a couple hours, look pretty good, right? But it's important for that season to end, or else you'll never know each other. And so that season came to an end, which began a 3-year season of long distance dating, where she goes, oh, you're more than this best version of yourself. And we got to know each other and we saw our flaws and we're still together. And then that season ended and we began this season of engagement for a year, which was one of our hardest seasons to this day that we had. We were moving to a new city, a new job, new community. I remember very distinctly we had this one fight. We were in the parking lot of my 500 square foot apartment, and we, you know, gotten some words in. And then she got in her, she had a yellow Honda CRX, got in the car, drove off. And I just felt so hopeless and angry, and I just shook my fist at the sky. And then the next morning, I was like, I know what to do. I'm going to John Cusack this, right? So I got some flowers, I got a boombox, and I was like, I've seen the movie. I know how this works. So I show up at her house. I didn't have a boombox was in my mind. And I show up with flowers, with like this big bouquet, and I ring the doorbell. And in my mind, she was going to open the window. I'd sing a song, and then she'd get a rope and come down, and we'd hug, and then we'd live happily forever after. But I rang the doorbell, and then she didn't open the door. Think, oh, that's strange, because her car is right here. So I rang the doorbell again. So in hindsight, I should have stopped after the second doorbell. But I was confused, and then confusion kind of turned into anger. And then as I'm ringing the doorbell again, she's getting angrier and angrier, and she's thinking, I'm going to marry an aggressive doorbell ringer. And then she's crying, and I remember driving off in my car, just wiping my tears with wildflowers. And then that season came to an end, and then we got married, and you have your honeymoon, you begin this new season, and then that season ended quicker than we thought. We're like, surprise, we're pregnant. And I was too young to actually even name the end of that season. Andrew Bird has a new album. Have you heard his new song? It's called The Valley of the Young, and he talks about he's having a kid now, and he's leaving because he's having a kid. He's leaving the Valley of the Young, and I heard this song, and I was like, I've experienced that. This is what he says. He says, do you need a reason? We should commit treason and bring into this world a son and leave the valleys of the young, the valleys of the young, valleys of brunch and tedium. Well, your friends will become strange to you. I was like, I remember that because we were young parents. None of our friends were having kids. Your friends will become strange to you. Just as you will become strange to them, you'll live across this great divide and problems that seem like luxuries. They're off getting stoned and hugging trees. All the things you'll be forsaking, still our hearts are constantly breaking from their cradle to our grave. And then he asked this question about having kids. Is it selfish or is it brave? And I remember, I was like, I've been in that season. Because we left the Valley of the Young. It was like, surprise. Then we had one son. And then we left the season of having one child to two children. And I remember it felt like a family. And so for being married 18 years, there's all these things that end so that new things can begin. And it's healthy and maturing. Krista Tippett on Being, she interviewed this researcher, Helen Fisher. She teaches at Rutgers. And she's an anthropologist, and she talks about how for most of human history, people get married three times, even if it's to the same person. So for the first time, you get married for sex, second time for offspring, and then the third time for companionship. And I remember when I heard that, I was like, oh, I think we're working on our third marriage right now. We got a little time still. We still have kids around the house, but we got to begin working on that third marriage. Because the pattern of life, the pattern of healthy relationships, and I would propose the pattern of life with God, where things end, which is just the other side of a beginning. And when you read the scriptures, God talks a lot about making things new, but every time he makes something new, that means the old thing is ending, right? Jeremiah talks about how his mercies are new every morning. Like it's like the fish, it's limitless. But that means the old mercies, the old version of how mercy was shown, will end so that new mercies can come forth. Jesus talks about how when you have new wine, there has to be new wineskins. So when there's new wines, there's new expressions, the form has to be new. But that means the old wineskins have to end so that new things can begin. And then in John's apocalyptic dream, he pictures Jesus saying, I will make all things new. Which also means that all things will come to an end so that things can be made new again. It's the pattern of relationships and our life and the universe. And then the story finishes, and it's this picture of Jesus restoring Peter, who betrays him. And it's, you know, some of you may have heard this story, but he says to Peter, and Peter comes with his tail between his legs. He's embarrassed. Then he says to Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he uses the word for limitless, unconditional love. He says, do you love me unconditionally? And then Peter says, ah, God, I'll love you as a friend. But I think he's saying, I'll love you as best as I can as a human being. And then Jesus is like, yeah, it's good. You're now involved in leading the church. That'll do. Then he asks him a second time, do you love me the way I love you? Like, I can't love you any more than or any less. I love you because you're lovable. I love you because I'm loved. Do you love me in that way? And then Peter goes, I'll be your friend. Is that good enough? And then in the last time, Jesus asks him, will you love me as a friend? And Peter was hurt because he asked him a third time. And then he says, I'll love you as a friend. And so this is almost too obvious to name, but I think it's worth exploring a little bit. So when there's something in our life that needs forgiving, that's an opportunity for fermentation and new life to happen. When there's someone that needs to be forgiven, when ourselves need to be forgiven, it's an opportunity for life. And this is the thing. Our animal side, the reptilian brain, right? When someone wrongs me, when there's injustice, my reptilian brain wants justice and it feels really good, right? That's kind of the Darwinian mammalian side of me. So that's why Quentin Tarantino is a successful director, right? He's made a living off of that one core Darwinian instinct in us. So when Uma Thurman needs to kill Bill, right? And it doesn't take one film, it takes two because she's got her hit list of five. And in the first film, she only takes care of two. And then every one of her hit lists, right, she deserves, it's justice. And it kind of feels really good. Like ideologically, I don't even agree with it. But when justice is served, there's like a part of me that's like fist bumping, right? Yeah. And then the next one. So with Inglourious Basterds, it feels really good when a Southern Brad Pitt is enacting vengeance on Nazi generals because of the, I know it's fiction, but it still feels good. I'm like, get him, he deserves it. And I'm like, what am I doing? I'm not like that, right? And then when a slave, an injustice has happened to his wife, you're like, oh yeah, he really needs to get his. And this is the thing. This is the pattern of the world. It's the Darwinian world we live in. And this story is supposed to show us, no, the fermentation, new life, death just leads to more death. But when you meet injustice with grace and relationship, that's the only way that new life is formed. Richard Rohr says it like this. He says, every time God forgives us, forgives me, God's saying that his own rules don't matter as much as the relationship that God wants to create with us. So whenever we deal with someone or ourselves that needs to be forgiven, the question we're asking is, do I want to be right or do I care about this relationship? What's more important? When we're arguing about politics and we're all over the map, what's more important, being right or this relationship of this person that I'm talking to? Even theological differences, what's more important, being right or this relationship? And then when someone comes and takes something that's ours and hurts us, in that moment, in forgiveness, that's the question we're asking. What's more important here, being right or this relationship? Peter one time said to Jesus, oh, okay, let's make forgiveness like a math thing. So seven times, it feels like a lot, right? Just like one, two, like three gets kind of hard and you push through to four, five, six, seven. And then Jesus is like, no, 70 times, it's limitless. It's not a question of math, it's a question of values. Every time, in every single situation, the person is more important than ideological rightness. And then on the cross, he's hanging there and people are mocking him, spitting at him. They're putting nails through his hands. And his last words are, Father, forgive them. Father, I choose all of these people and their relationship more than the rightness and wrongness of what they're doing to me in this moment. Meister Eckhart says it like this. He says, you may call God love. That's good. You can call him that. You may call God goodness. But the best name for God is compassion. And so for us, you know, what would it look like this week, just day to day, to notice fermentation, to notice things that are decaying and that are possibly being born to life? And so I'll close with this clip.
Smelling, and I smell, by the way. You have to smell everything. If you have smelled a strong cheese, especially cheese that has Brevi bacteria, you might think it's dirty socks, it's the earth. You don't really want to talk about what cheese reminds you of, because it reminds you of these earthy places, even in our own bodies. This sense that we're eating decomposition, breakdown products, you could call it death. To me, it's a taste of that, but a promise of something delicious. So I think it's almost a subconscious way of being prepared for death and facing our own mortality. And for me, that analogy of really a death, a decomposition, creating this wonderful flavor, it's a promise of something better. I experience that over and over again when I look at cheese, when I smell cheese, and when then I look at the microbial ecology of cheese. That's the wonder for me, that it's a promise of life beyond death.